So today is March 24th, and I'm here. This is an interview with Jeremy Cronin. He's the Deputy Minister of Transport for South Africa. Thank you so much for your time, sir. Perhaps we can just get started by getting a bit of your background and some of the background to the steps that you took along your career before becoming Deputy Minister.
Okay. So English speaking, white South African, and my parents advised me not to get involved in politics. They said leave that to the Afrikaners, blacks in South Africa, which was wise advice, which I was pursuing as a first year student in 1968 at the University of Cape Town, and the sort of distant echoes of the 1968 student rebellions in California and Germany and France and so on reached all white university at that stage of the University of Cape Town. I got politicized in 1968 and got recruited into the deep underground of the South African Communist Party in 1968. Couldn't join the ANC as a white person at that stage. It wasn't open to white membership. I studied at the Sorbonne. My area of specialization was political philosophy, basically. Lectured briefly at the University of Cape Town, then was arrested and spent 7 years as a political prisoner during the apartheid period. And then, as the judge predicted, returned to my sort of political underground activity, but also to the what was then the mass democratic movement of the mid-80s. I was briefly in exile with the ANC in its exile headquarters in Lusaka. Took part in the negotiations process in the early 1990s, came to Parliament, was full-time in the Communist Party, basically. In 1999, the second elections, became chairperson of the board. I served in that position through two terms, more recently with the 2009 elections, was elected again and became the Deputy Minister of Transport. So that's basically it, yeah.
Excellent. Perhaps you can provide just a little bit of a background to what you see as the challenges of transport in South Africa. I mean, I know that there are various different modes of transport, and they all have to interact with each other. Later, I'd like to talk a little bit about how we work on getting that interaction. Just to give a picture of the challenge as you see it.
Well, I think South Africa, whether one's talking transport or pretty much anything else, is sharply marked still by duality. The strange combination of a relatively advanced first world and a very significant third world, to use metaphoric language, that plays itself out across a range of areas, not least in transport in South Africa. So on the one hand, we have a relatively efficient national logistics grid, which was put in place in the early 20th century, really, on the back of the mining revolution, which occurred. One of the good fortunes and bad fortunes of South Africa is that our mineral endowment is deep in the hinterland, and that's what created South Africa for the first place. The Anglo-World War, a range of other things, 1910. And it was built around a freight logistics network, which was really about connecting the mining centers in the hinterland with the old colonial ports. And that reality, both in terms of freeways and road networks and rail networks, remains pretty much still today the key arteries of the freight logistics system. And particularly on the rail side, to some extent on the port side, suffered from lack of recapitalization during the latter years of apartheid, as it began to consume huge amounts of money on defense and policing. Generally, we've got a pretty modern network of freeways, key trunk systems, and key rail systems, and relatively efficient port systems. And of course, obviously now, quite significant airport build as So that's the one side of the story. The other side of the story is massive challenges in terms of basic access and mobility for a great majority of South Africans. And the area of my particular involvement and passion and concern is in the area of public transport, basically. Essentially, the geography that apartheid put in place, well, that it reinforced because it had been put in place earlier, is a spatial reality that persists still in South Africa. So on the one hand, you've got the former Bantustans, which prior to that had been native reserves, which were basically some 30% of the land surface of South Africa, and which were basically labor reserves exporting not cotton or cocoa, but their principal crop was migrant labor for the mines. With increasing urbanization of the African majority in South Africa, and particularly post-Second World War, during the Second World War, with industrialization leaping ahead, and also the collapse of reserve economies, there was a massive influx of black people into the cities. And that's what apartheid in its first decade was really about, was dealing with this reality. And the way in which it dealt with the reality was into distant dormitory townships. So you had a replication of native reserves, but now in an urban setting. And unfortunately, since 1994, since the democratic breakthrough in 1994, well-intentioned policies, for instance, of a massive building of housing, low-cost housing. So we built some 3.1 million so-called RDP, reconstruction and development program houses, which is a significant achievement. But in order to maximize the number of these houses, low-cost houses or free houses for poor people within budget, what we've done is we built them in the same distant locations, and they are not communities so much as rows and rows and rows of, as the people living in them describe it, matchbox houses, which look exactly like the matchbox houses that were built in Soweto and many other places, townships in South Africa during the apartheid period of the 50s and 60s. And so we've compounded the spatial exclusion of large numbers of poor, working class and poor people, and the challenges of transport and mobility, and therefore of public transport, because large numbers, about 33% of South African households have access to a car, a great majority don't. So we've got huge challenges on that front in terms of mobility and access. And we can't solve them from a transport perspective unless we also think about spatial transformation, the built environment, proper urban planning, a range of things like that. So that's kind of a broad brushstroke perspective on some of the issues that we're confronting on transport.
I'd like to go to the period in the late 1990s. There's a push, in the democratic era to look for different models of how to run some of these departments, these ministries. And one of the main pushes is to look to the private sector for lessons of how to run. And so the agency model is something that comes out of this. Could you maybe describe a little bit of what that transition period was like and what some of the driving forces of that transition were?
I wasn't up close on that process, and not being in government or in parliament in between 94 and 99, and that's when much of it happened. Certainly the action happened in the Department of Transport. There was a very active transformation of much of the department into a series of standalone but related agencies, public entities, but falling under the Department of Transport. And obviously one significant one was SANRAL, but there were a range of others. There's some 11 entities that fall under the Department of Transport currently. many of them created in this time. And essentially, they were spun out of subdivisions within the existing Department of Transport. I mean, what was spurring that, I think, would have been a number of things. The one would have been the need to transform the public sector itself, very white-dominated. Reorient the mandate of the state and so forth. So, secondly, I think there were also considerable budgetary pressures on departments, and particularly not least a department like transport, which was seen as very large and bloated, but also not one of the key priorities. I think we've succeeded in the last 5 years in perhaps positioning the department as being a little bit more central and more important to achieving many other things. But understandably, things like housing and education and health were accorded, you know, great priority and significant budget was allocated there. Other departments were told, like transport, were told to, you know, find other ways of managing. So think of yourself less as an operational implementing department and more as a policy type department, a regulatory department. So I think those were some of the buzzwords that floated around. Steer rather than row, all of those familiar things. So I think that was that. And I clearly, public management theory, which I think, you know, which was never entirely part of the Washington consensus, but was not unrelated to it. So South Africa, you know, the ANC and its alliance partners came into government at a curious time, Scandinavia, Britain, whatever, or the sort of more radical national movements in Southern Africa, or Vietnam or somewhere else, not to mention the big one for us, you know, Berlin Wall going down and stuff. All of those, I think, meant that there was one show in town, which was Washington consensus when it came to macroeconomic and economic policy. And I think aligned with that also was then also a set of beliefs around, you know, governments should be leaner, should focus more on steering rather than rowing, and a range of things like that. And not all of that was necessarily wrong, but I think a lot of it was imbibed rather uncritically in South Africa because there was just nothing else that seemed to have worked particularly well. And so we were also obviously confronted with the task of major transformation of a state, the apartheid state. We weakened it and defeated and forced it into a negotiated settlement. Which meant that, you know, we're still in the midst of a profound negotiation process, really, with the former incumbent economy, and in society and in the media and so forth. And so the transition is still very much underway, which makes it an interesting place, South Africa, for.
If you could just maybe introduce, I mean, what you think, we're very interested in the implementation aspects of what CENRAL does and how that model sort of affects that their ability to implement. Perhaps you could just...
Just to generalize, I think that a number of entities were created that were spun out of someone like Nazi Ali, I think, had been a chief director or something like that in the roads section of the department. And so it wasn't the only entity created. A variety of them were created. There was the Cross-Border Road Traffic Agency Authority, CBRTA. A bit later, a rail safety regulator, a national port regulator. Ones like CENRAL, this is the airports company of South Africa. They've been well-run entities which have been able to leverage funding and resources to do things off budget, and yeah, I mean, have built airports, renovated airports, and have built an impressive 16,000 core. First thing is leadership. I think that in both cases, I mean, someone like Nazir Ali is obviously a very effective leader. And the same is applied also to the CEO of the airports company of South Africa. Sort of a bright generation of black South Africans and so forth. Nazir are very technically competent as well. Professionally skilled, obviously, as opposed to just being a manager of an agency with a CEO title and his own independent office and nice salary and so forth, has actually brought professional skills to bear on the reality. And I think that's been really important because what is the expertise that's there? Well, I think there's an engineering expertise, and they've experimented, and he would have told you probably at a fair degree of length, at some of the interesting technological innovations that they've sought to brought to bear. I know he's in demand, and therefore Sanral's in demand in Afghanistan and interesting places like this as well, because of the ability to do interesting things in a third world developing country type situation. And thank goodness we're not quite Afghanistan, although we got close to being like that at certain points of our history. So it's interesting technically, I mean, in terms of technologies that they've brought to bear and adaptation to third world type realities that would apply perhaps a little bit less than they should have done, but that's mainly because they're dealing with the national road network, but also labor intensity methods. We push him in, he would have, I think, talked about that. It's certainly of interest to us. I think some of our provinces and their roads departments have done better on that front in terms of employing poor households, for instance, along stretches of road to maintain a section of road for a small stipend with some training and so forth. And those are very nice and interesting experiments in the context of high levels of unemployment and poverty and inability for the state in its bureaucratic form to actually maintain roads effectively and so forth, the rural roads and so on. So there's been some interesting stuff. And Samuel's been a little bit involved in that. And we've always politically put pressure on them to not necessarily go with the most capital-intensive ways of building roads and repairing them, but clearly when you're getting to the high end of road, it's a little bit more challenging than with a gravel rural road. I think an absolutely critical skill, and one which is so lacking in government very often, is the ability to enter into contracts and to project manage. You know, that's the big thing. So whether it's an agency like Sanral or it's a more line department, whether at a provincial level or national level, we're all doing this. Mm-hmm. We're all, you know, we're, lots of stuff, not least on roads, is contracted out to civil engineers, mm-hmm. by and large. And therefore this interface between the public sector, whether it's an agency or a line department, and the private sector, and competence in that area is so absolutely essential. Mm-hmm. I think it's the great strength of a personality like Nazir, but the team that he's built and the entity that he's built. Mm-hmm. We have another relatively good example with the Gautrain as well, mm-hmm. The Gautrain Management Agency, and there again there's an engineer who's this CEO of the PPP process, mm-hmm. In its contractual phase, but also in its project management phase. That's about the limits of the positive.
So just as a quick follow-up before we get to maybe some of the challenges of the model.
I mean, what are some of the things that you can do as that your ministry can do to when you're interacting? I'd love in a little bit to talk about that interaction, but to encourage things like the development of best practices on working with contracts. I mean, how do you because presumably certain agencies do it better than other agencies. So how do you work with the agencies, or do you work with the agencies to try to encourage them? Because this is a critical aspect of all parts of the process.
Yeah. I think the short answer is, certainly in the experience that we've got, the good agencies are the ones, or entities are the ones that are good at this, and our ability to assist them is weak.
Okay.
So we don't have too many engineers in the department. Mm-hmm. What we do rely on is our treasury. So on some of these big contracts, there's a PPP unit in the treasury, and there's a considerable level of skill there in treasury. So we would work, and they would insist in any case if we didn't. But personally, I find that the skills from the line department side of things are not in our department of transport. Are much more either line in a good entity, a bad entity, you don't find it, on the one hand, and in treasury. And so whether it's the Gautrain effort or now with the challenge that we've got around the tolling with the GFIP process, I've been asked by the minister he's the area that he's pushed me into, he's asked me to kind of assemble a team to look at what kind of wriggle room do we have in this, and we don't have too much, but anyway, we need to look at it. And we're going to be relying on the competence in SANRAL and in Treasury rather than more than, I mean, our job in transport is more to coordinate those efforts as between the entity that falls under us but often gets away. And treasury, so it's more coordinated rather than our ability, as it were, to help a SANRAL or a Gautrain project or an Airports Company of South Africa project to do a better contract and so on. We simply don't have that skill, partly because it's gone out of the department into these entities, and for other reasons as well. Yeah.
I mean, that provides a good sort of entrance to the topic of some of the challenges of the model, because in sort of having this, I won't want to say privatized, but using the private lessons to run some of these agencies.
It's a corporatization.
Corporatization, I guess, is a great word for it. Great. You do lose a lot of your sort of control over the operations. I mean, how do those challenges present themselves in sort of the day-to-day, and what are some of the other challenges and maybe drawbacks to the model?
I think the other big issue that we're running into a great deal is indeed the structure of the entity. So all of these entities have boards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think there's a big challenge here in South Africa around these boards generally, and I'm not alone in thinking this. In fact, yesterday in a cabinet committee there was this discussion unrelated to transport, but a number of other line departments were raising the matter as well. The structures vary, but typically you have an agency of some kind, which may be more regulatory. Many of them are that primarily, but others are more like SANRAL or the Airports Company of South Africa, or Transnet, which is the big one, or Eskom, which is another big one, which are actually operators of one kind or another, doing things. Building things and operating airports or whatever. But they all tend to have the same broad structure, which is an entity that's often been spun out of a line department, standing on its own now with an ability to leverage funding in a variety of ways. The big ones like SANRAL issue bonds and things like that, maybe interesting things like that, or alternatively they get into PPPs of one kind or another, so they're able to resource funding, and that's the attraction for us of it. In the case of the regulators, they tend to also be self-funding, but out of regulatory charges, levies of one kind or another. So we like that, because it kind of reduces our budget. But then they all have boards. Okay. Now, the justification of these boards in the case of entities that, for instance, are issuing bonds and so forth is that, well, that's a requirement very often in terms of global lending. The boards tend to be quite problematic. Now, we've not particularly had that problem with SANRAL, for instance, but it lurks around in all of these entities. So typically, you will have a department which is regarded as the policy department. You might even have another department, which is looking after some of the big SOEs, but not all of them. So quite the logic of why some are sitting with public enterprises and others are sitting with a line department like ourselves is not entirely clear.
Mm-hmm.
The history of that is that in the last years of the apartheid regime, they were looking to privatize some of them. The apartheid regime ran as a quite significant public sector and SOE sector. And they were getting ready in the sort of late 80s under budgetary pressures and a variety of other new developments to privatize. And they're never quite able to. So we inherited a Department of Public Enterprises, which is really a privatization department. And that, I need to just, yeah, we're okay.
As I understand it, the roads department within the Department of Transport, before the transition, had a board. I mean, so this some of these structures were
okay.
sort of transitioning.
That,
okay.
Okay.
I mean, like
yeah.
maybe that's I'll check that. But
no,
as
sure
it was explained
right.
to me, like that there was sort of this process was more of an evolution rather than sort of
yeah.
a revolution.
No, I'm sure that's the case. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
But these boards are problematic. I mean, in the sense that they, I mean, because the Minister of Transport is the sole shareholder. You know, in the sense that he does appoint seven of the eight board members.
Yes.
So I mean, but there's they
okay,
seem to be
in the case of SANRAL, that's the case.
Okay.
It varies. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But still, the control issue over or maybe just the issue of sort of who's giving the marching orders or what the strategies
yes.
are. I mean, that
as between exactly the broad policy, which clearly in legislation, I haven't looked at the SANRAL legislation, and I wasn't responsible for it. It was just before me.
Right.
Before I got into parliament, but the minister typically appoints the board members, but they often acquire then and should acquire a life of their own.
Mm-hmm.
But as between their function, which would be described in law,
mm-hmm.
and the department and therefore minister's function, sometimes there rubs. But in many cases, also the not so much in SANRAL, because I think partly because there's a strong CEO. The board starts to acquire business interests, quite frankly. So quite a lot of the what we call tenderpreneurship and corruption and so on seems to circulate around a number of these boards. And certainly we've run into some problems in some of the other entities that we've got with and it's very often linked to BEE, so the emerging black business interest and so forth. And spotting tenders that are coming up in the entity that you're throwing it to friends and family and so forth. So that's an issue, not a problem with SANRAL that I'm aware of particularly. But yeah, okay. To go right back to the beginning of what I was saying, the danger is that we reproduce the dualities of our situation. That we perpetuate this first world, third world reality. You see, I think through the better part of the 1990s and even until quite recently, until we started to talk about a new growth path, the assumption was that sort of growth in the formal economy would be the tide that would lift all
right.
ships or boats or whatever the saying is. That hasn't proven to be the case, that we've had growth until the global crisis hit us in 2008. It wasn't spectacular growth, but it was 3, getting up to 4, touching 5% towards the end. But the huge problems of unemployment, underdevelopment, poverty and inequality have persisted and been reproduced.
Mm-hmm.
And they've already flagged the spatial issue, the kind of displacement of people into distant dormitory townships as being something that we've actually strengthened and deepened as a result of a well-intentioned housing program, for instance. And the same question applies to our road network system. We've got a very efficient first world operating in a SANRAL, which has ensured that we've retained and even extended this wonderful first world freeway network system we've got. There's been some interesting other developments like the Maputo Corridor, which is an interesting regional road system. But even there, the interesting questions to ask, I mean, when we talk to Mozambicans, has the Maputo Corridor really helped development in Mozambique as it was intended to do? Or is it a digestive tube, basically? You know, sort of, because one of the fastest growing cities in South Africa is Nelspruit, and I could never work out why until I had a close look at the Maputo Corridor and realized that the elite of the diplomats, but also the sort of elite of Maputo, are now 1.5 hours away from Pick and Pay and Checkers and Woolworths and so on, and they will shop.
Mm-hmm.
They shop, come on a weekend, they use the nice new Maputo Corridor to shop in South Africa and go back and so on. So that's nice for Nelspruit, but I'm not sure its developmental impact in terms of, you know, in terms of Mozambique. But anyway.
So it's a challenge to think about, you know, strategically, with a sensitivity to a lot of these spatial issues.
The average public transport trip distance in London is of the order of 8.5 kilometers. In Moscow, apparently, I think it's something like 7.7 kilometers. In Tshwane, it's 25.5 kilometers. So, that, you know, Tshwane is probably about the worst of our cities, but most of our cities are like that. So, there's this. So poor people are made poorer in terms of just the expense, the time. And of course, that impacts then on productivity levels and all kinds of stuff. There's a whole knock-on effect. So we've got a big spatial problem, and therefore our transport infrastructure needs to be, but also built environment, urban planning, planning in general, or spatial planning. All of those things need to think about that. Need to be careful that our well-intentioned interventions don't compound the problem rather than help to begin to be transformative. The transformation is going to take a long time. It's not 10 days that shake the world. It's going to be complicated. But we need to make sure that, because particularly with infrastructure, when you put down infrastructure, you're putting down something that lasts for 50 years and locks you into you know, space. So this really, I think, relates then to the toll issue that we're confronting. Because Nazir's, and therefore us, we're confronting two toll issues. Tolls are not popular worldwide.
Right.
And why would they be? You understand. But when you toll in South Africa, you've got to think about what you're doing. And the two toll problems, Scott, which is the coastal road that goes from Cape Town all the way up to the Mozambican border along the coast, basically. And there's a major refurbishment and realignment, actually, of sections along the wonderful wild coast. I don't know if you've been there. It's the sort of former Transkei.
Okay.
There's sort of deep rural areas of wonderful coast, basically, very wild. And would open it up, therefore. We need to be careful of that, but
sure.
Would open up to tourism and therefore to livelihoods and so on for people living. You can't toll that stretch because it's a poor community.
Right.
And therefore the tolling would have to happen in KwaZulu-Natal. And KwaZulu-Natal, thanks to Lazia Ale, is the most tolled province of all by far in South Africa. So there's massive opposition in KwaZulu-Natal to tolling an improvement to the N2 with which where of course they'll get told, but the beneficiaries will be their poorer cousins, and Transguide. So you're getting this. I mean, the whole of KwaZulu-Natal is not first world, of course, but you're getting this duality issue cropping up. It's the same with GFIP, because what we've got there is a revolt of white middle classes living their Santa Barbara lifestyles, green suburbs, townhouse developments in the middle of nowhere, mid-rest.
And having a commute 25 kilometers to work.
Yeah. You're also not going to get caught in this urban toll system. So you get the rural urban duality, and here you're getting the urban duality.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a problem with tolling. People have to have choices. If they want their 4x4s and their shopping malls and their commutes to work in order to live in a relatively green suburb, fine, then they should pay for it, because we're supporting their lifestyle with helping decongest their commute temporarily, because we know that freeway expansions in the US and everywhere else solve congestion for a couple of years, and then you get more townhouses and more shopping malls. But it is a huge problem when you're hitting the poor as well, who've been displaced far out. And that's now the dilemma. So we've got first world toys there now, and this, you know, these electronic tolling system. I have big questions around compliance.
Right. There's going to be a lot of issues. I mean, anytime you do something like this,
okay.
I mean, yeah, there's all sorts of other side industries.
So in short,
yeah,
you've got a very well-run Sunrail.
Right.
You know, doing interesting things in doing interesting first world things almost, but not quite in a first world setting, and understanding that somewhat. But, and it's not their fault, because at the end of the day, Nazia will tell you, but you know, all of this has been signed off by the likes of us.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't quite me, because I wasn't quite there then, but Gauteng Province, National, and so forth, agreed to all of this. Very much driven by them, and they knew what they were doing, and obviously the politicians signed off without quite working out what it was going to mean in terms of cost, tolling costs and so on. So I'm giving you a glimpse of what I think is the great asset that we've got in Sunrail, but the potential problem that we've got in Sunrail as well. It's looking after, it's cherry-picked. Well, we've asked it to cherry-pick. It's looking after the sexy part of the road system and not the hugely problematic part of it. It does so with a great deal of confidence. So what I'm hoping to do, where I'm hoping to steer Sunrail into, is, and there's some experience, and they've done some nice things in this respect as well, is to see it more as a kind of, to use its technical skills and competence, not to run the 17, I think eventually 20,000 kilometers of national road, although hopefully we don't abandon that, because we need to hold on to what we've got, but to see them much more as an entity that works very closely with provinces and municipalities as well as looking after national, and transfers skills, so helps them to contract, helps them to project manage, and so forth. Acts as an agency that facilitates that kind of thing, because that's where the huge problems are that we've got. You know, I engaged Nazir on this, and I mean, he's quite excited about that, and they have entered into some MOUs, memoranda of understanding with provinces, for instance. And in fact, part of the tolling, the R21, I think it is, was a provincial road, and it's been handed over in an MOU to. So, I'd like to see MOUs for other, you know, to identify areas where there's like real underdevelopment. Professional skills to enable
in the non-national roads in the provincial level.
Yeah, huge problems on the front.
So
I need to watch time.
Yeah, okay. Well, just as we finish up, is there anything? Is there anything else that you know, that we've left out that you think might be pertinent to the the discussion?
I've probably stretched beyond.
The last maybe brief question that I have then is this turnover of ministers. When you have, I mean, roads is something that you have a very, you need a long-term perspective on what your infrastructure plans are going to be. How do you deal with the fact that, you know, there are going to be turnovers in the minister, and then people who sign off on one project, you know, the next person coming in may not think that that's a priority. I mean, is that a challenge, and how do you deal with that challenge?
It's a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge. And I suppose that's one of the advantages of having agencies and entities, that they have a lifespan beyond. I mean, obviously your bureaucracy should, within line departments, should also have a degree of permanence, but certainly in the last period that's not been the case. There was a high turnover, not just of ministers and political heads, but also of senior staff in all departments. In our department is a case in point. Since 94, I think there have been something like 6 directors general. Which is not to say that there isn't sometimes turnover in some of the entities, but for instance, another interesting thing about San Alto, you're reminding me, is there's been this permanence of a CEO who's been there through numbers of ministers and lots of DGs and things like that. And that's really important. Obviously, you need to get shift people who are not doing their job and so on, but the rotation that happens politically is problematic, compounded in the South African reality by a number of other things. I mean, the high level of turnover at a senior department level, if we look at our department, what happens is first of all, shifted a lot of people out because they were white incumbents and so on, sometimes unfairly, sometimes they needed to go because they were just not up to the new reality. So a whole new cadre of young, typically young, very young, black senior managers in line departments. But then also we're at the same time putting pressure on the private sector to introduce employment equity and to promote BE partners and things like this. And so there's a huge, basically the public sector employs these young postgraduates.
Mm-hmm.
Very skilled often and very bright. They spend a few years in a department acquiring skills. They'll come with a generic skill, but then will acquire a specific skill. And then quite quickly will go out into the private sector. And so we encounter them all the time in sort of engineering companies and a range of other entities that we're dealing with. So we're training them and then losing them. So the turnover is party political turnover, elections and so forth. But it's also problematically in this transitional type reality that South Africa is, there's a very high level of turnover of staff. And they get poached because we put pressure on the private sector to grab these people and they pay salaries which we can't manage.
Well, I know you have to go. Thank you so much for your time.
No,
I appreciate it.
Very nice to meet you.